Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Welcome to my good bad brain. I'm a normal person, so I'm insane. I've got depression and ADHD, but I'm doing better since I medicated me. I'm still not always sure whether I exist or what being a person even really is, but I figured out a long time ago that being alive is beautiful.
Hello, friends. Welcome back to My Good Bad Brain. A return to interviews. I wanted to do some interviews again. I'd been kind of thinking about it. It's just been scheduling and weirdness and whatever. My mom was in town last week, and I had long wanted to talk with my mom on the podcast. She has a lot of experience with, I mean, just life, man. She's amazing. She's raised six kids. She's traveled the world. She's an amazing businesswoman. She's made fortunes and lost fortunes and been through the ringer. She had some tough stuff in her childhood, and she's done a lot of work. Something that amazes me about Christine Mason, who is also my mom, she had me young, and that made some things hard, I think, when we were kids, because that's how it felt. It felt like we were growing up together. And, moms are moms. We tend to just think of our moms as moms, not really dimensional people. And there's these weird barriers between how we speak to each other. And I think a lot of moms, like most of us, decide that, yes, they are a mom, just like my dad was like, I am a lawyer until he was not. Or other people, you know, whatever. I am a dad. I am a girlfriend or boyfriend. I am a thing. You get a category and you stop, you know, you start chipping away at your dimensional identity of what am I, this living inquiry. And you just start adding labels and understanding that's who you are. And in some ways, that makes other people safe. That makes them feel secure, I think. People like a narrative that they can understand and hold in their hand or write down in a nice little blurb on the back of a book or a Wikipedia page. But humans are so infinitely dimensional unless they choose not to be. Unless they consciously attempt to become less than that. And even then, they still are infinitely dimensional. There's just, you know, because they're trying to adhere to their own simplicity of identity that they've decided, the path they've chosen, the channel that they've selected, you know, it's easier to pin them down because they're helping to fulfill that lesser dimensionality themselves. But the complexity of a mom or a grandmom or whoever is just as infinite as ours as a child when we're young and, wow, our brains are moving so fast and we think of all this stuff. And my mom, I appreciate that she never stopped being that way, inquisitive and passionate and so seeking. And when I was young, when I was a kid, in times that I really wanted a mom to just be a mom, that would be tough for me. I'd get frustrated or angry because she was trying to find herself too. She had me when she was 19, though. That means that would be me having like a 13-year-old boy and two or three other kids at that point. Also, that's crazy. The amount of time I spend thinking about myself, quite frankly, my process and my I don't know, identity and my history and, you know, who, what am I doing? Who am I? Is crazy. And if I didn't have the time to process that and the space to process that, which becomes one of the things that my mom and I talk about, is creating space for yourself to process things in time and understanding that it's not a luxury that everyone can afford. You know, I would probably have not been the best dad. I probably wouldn't be the best dad all the time. But someone once said that, you know, parenting isn't about single events. It's not like the one time you screw someone up, like you say something messed up to your kid because you're angry or you're tired or whatever, and they're scarred forever. That parenting is something you show up for every day. It's something in more of a collective. And I think there's a little, obviously you can scar people. We all have memories of those one things that were like, oh, you said this one thing. And but that I do think it's true that you're talking about who sticks around over time, who shows up over time when you talk about the good parents. Who, how are you overall? And my mom, in remaining in her inquiry and changing and healing and figuring things out and fucking things up and having new questions and just continuing to grow and be active about that and open about it and in conversation about it, I truly feel, and I've discussed my siblings, has been a great boon to us. Sometimes her figuring stuff out or working things out means that we don't have to for ourselves. It's like someone ahead of us in the line of our generational ancestral passed on trauma has healed some of it. And in her healing it, we don't have to do it anymore. Because the buck, you know, in terms of like epigenetic inheritance of inherited ancestral trauma tends to stop with us. And so that's the biggest topic that I jump off of with my mom is the subject of trauma. She's worked on a bunch of programs, which she'll get into, and she's in a study program now surrounding violence, healing from trauma. And she's had some traumas in her own life. Her mom died, and then she found out a little bit after that that she was murdered when my mom was 12-ish. We get into that. And I obviously never knew her. My grandma has always been, my grandma is actually my step grandma, but technically, but, that would be really hard, I think, for anybody to lose a parent that young. And especially when you become a mother to so many children and you're missing, you know, that modeling potentially that then you really are trying to figure it out as you go. And I think we figured it out as we went as a mom and a child, sort of in concert. And I guess part of what I wanted to do in talking to my mom on this podcast was just, I don't know, a little bit of me is a little bit just proud of our dynamic and kind of wanted to put out there that, like, yeah, you can talk to your mom like this. You can talk to your parents like this. And I know that takes two to tango. Not everybody is into that. But sometimes I realized, sometimes I thought, I was like, oh, we and our family dialogue in ways that maybe not everybody does or is a little non-traditional. And I think that would be fun to bring on the pod. That being said, moving forward, I am going to be trying to get into more interviews. I think I got daunted by not just scheduling, but trying to do like outreach and trying to get friends who had more like names or followers or something like that. And I'll still do that occasionally and do some reach out to other you know, people and folks like that. But, or, you know, whatever, some kind of following type people, like get those hits. But the reason I started this podcast was everyday mental health, you know, everyday existential, answering for ourselves. And, I really kind of want to just reapproach that, and keep interviews as we move forward a little bit more focused on that. Simple question, what mental health struggles do you have daily and how are you getting through from people who are, you know, that's a little tricky. You know, you don't always know how well someone's getting through. You just have to guess. But I do think a lot of us struggle with mental health issues or existential issues and get through beautifully. And I kind of want to just focus on that more, quote unquote, normal people, everyday people. I think being some kind of public figure is wonderful, and they're obviously all complex humans, but they deal with sets of things that are a little different sometimes. There are some different pressures and different strange situations, existentially speaking, that obviously they're relatable because of their humanity and their rich ability to describe it. But I'm interested in talking to people who, you know, maybe don't, maybe are a little more quote unquote normal, you know, because I think mental health is struggles are normal, like very normal. And I think it's helpful to hear how normal people exist with them, you know? So yeah, expect more interviews and with just quote unquote normals, you know? yeah. Anyway, let's get into this one with my mother, Christine Mason. And yeah, really, really, I don't know, man. This is, I'll talk about this more later, but I've been busy and crazy, and my good bad brain is really special to me. And I appreciate those of you who are sticking with this little experiment, because it is something I return to. And we've been doing the damn thing, dude. We're over half a year on this bad boy. We're moving through it. I don't know if I've stuck with something that long and who knows how long. Anyway, here we are, a return to interviews with the woman. I mean, it's sort of appropriate to return to the genesis of a new thing with the person who generated me, my mother, wonderful, brilliant being, Christine Mason. Hi, Mom.
Hey, Jarrett.
I mean, I'm starting with the hi, Mom, because this is going to say with Christine Mason, but you are also my mom. And this is a nice, it's weird to do a podcast and say, I'm going to record a podcast with my mom, because I think that sounds very funny. And it's like, to people, they'd be like, oh, okay, so I'll be your mom. But you are, in fact, a very relevant guest to have on this podcast. Not just as my mom, not just as a weird therapy session where we work on my mental health and talk about do like a weird, you know, family therapy thing. But, the thing I really wanted to talk to you about or primarily focus on, is basically around trauma and like trauma healing and violence healing and stuff like that. Because you've done a lot of work in those areas and you've had experiences in those areas. And, just by coincidence or whatever, I think that anybody I've been talking to about having guests again, and you are my dive back into having guests, so this will be a fun thing, is around trauma, around PTSD and stuff like that. So, yeah, why don't you tell me, as if I weren't your son, as if you're talking, you know, about you relevant to this topic and what kind of person you are, things you do, you know?
Well, I think early on I got the hit that everything that happens in your life actually lives in your body. You know, it affects your body, it affects your cells, and you start carrying it around with you. You carry it around as anxiety, or you carry it around as fear, or you know, it's just there. And that we become so accustomed to carrying all that stuff that we might not even realize the origin of that discomfort. So for me, I was in my 30s when I became sort of aware of this hyper tense, anxious state that I was walking around in.
And I want to just, as an addendum, because I have personal experience with it, your 30s are different than I think the 30s of a lot of like millennials and post-millennials. you had kids young. You had me when you were 19, and then three more kids in the next decade.
Yeah. I was running a tech company in my 30s. I was working in the tech industry. I had four little children. You know, it was a very... Yes.
That's just different. I feel like that's, you're like the last turn of a previous generational moray, I feel like. I mean, I think there's parts of the country, obviously, that people still are having babies in their 20s and things like that. But in terms of like career, kids, going crazy, doing all this stuff.
I mean, I was an anomaly for that generation also. You know, I was really,
were you like,
you know,
Gen
X? My father sort of, I am. And my dad said, you know, if I went ahead and had you, that I would, you know, end up probably uneducated. And no offense to people who actually do live in tiny houses or trailer parks, living in a trailer park, uneducated and alone.
That's a grand
idea. That's what he said. Yeah. So, you know, I said, that's okay. I think we'll go ahead and welcome this little life. And so, yeah, I was in a different spot in my 30s. But I was also carrying not only the accomplishments and the responsibility, I was also carrying this really big imprint of the cultural thing that you have to be perfect. And yeah. So I was sort of doing that, and I was carrying a very old imprint of the loss of my mother.
The cultural, and, you mean yeah. as a woman, or do you mean as like, or just general puritanical Protestant?
I think American. You basically had, it's a little bit beyond Calvinism and Protestant. It goes even further. It goes into like the almost like a media cult that started that in the consumer movements after World War II and really amped up in the 70s and really amped up in the Reagan era, where it became more about the image that you're projecting than mm-hmm. your actual quality of life or your values being lived.
Sure.
There's a very big shift. And I mean, that's continued out today, I think, in LA. And, you know, the whole Instagram culture thing is so much about the yeah. image and the image being right. But at that began, and a couple, it married nicely with the sort of Calvinist perfection, I think, of both men and women at that time, you know? So
that's like the stuff that's satirized by like American Psycho and things like that. This like 80s, like start yeah. of that 80s, like crisp, yes. like I'm mm-hmm. so perfect mm-hmm. and put together and blah, 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 blah.
We call it stenciling the driveway.
Stenciling the driveway?
Yeah, that basically, you know, you everything was so good that even your driveway had to be edged with yeah. a little machine and then, you know.
Do you associate it with like German culture and heritage at all?
There is some of the Germanic thing, but I more associate it with the Martha Stewartization of homemaking yeah. and all of that stuff. And the body, you know, you had a little earlier than that time, you had sort of the Jane Fonda thing where your exposed body became a cult. And then you had the Martha Stewartization where your home became a cult. And they all became sort of fetish objects of perfection. And you were supposed to score in all of these areas. So that whole imprint was there. And Frank, there's just not enough time in a day, you know, to do all of that stuff, mm. to raise children with heart and spirit and joy and to, you know, work and bring home all the resources needed to do that. So, yeah.
You felt that was starting to trigger this, like, something is amiss in your experience.
For sure. And
it was you're saying that it was like the trying and the impossibility of that? Like, you started to get down on yourself because of those...
I was trying and succeeding, but I couldn't relax. And I ran into a friend of mine on the street who was in a similar role. Like, he ran a big company, had children at home, but he had transformed himself physically. He looked amazing. And I asked him what he had done because he looked amazing. Mm. You know, and he said, I started yoga. And this was like in 2002, 2001, before it was really hitting the mainstream like it is now. And he said, you look terrible. And you look terrible. And you're coming with me. I'll pick you up Friday at lunchtime and I'll take you to class. And I got in there and I did this whole practice. I could barely touch my toes. You know, now I'm doing full splits in every direction. So that's actually saying a lot about the plasticity of the body and yeah. how much it can change over time. But when we got to the end, and
because you didn't even start till your 30s, you're saying,
right? 32, well, 31, nice 32. Hear, yeah. So I got into that last pose, which is Shavasana or corpse pose. And there's t-shirts now that said, I'm only here for the Shavasana,
right?
But that's actually legit, like why I came back, because it was the only time that I could remember in my adult life where I had relaxed.
I think that's also the hook of CrossFit that makes people get stuck on it. Why CrossFit was so successful and such a like. You know, phenomenal thing that's now its own thing. Like, if you're doing CrossFit, you're really only doing CrossFit, like, to compete at CrossFit. It's a very specific thing. But I relate that moment to, there's a similar thing at the end of some of those workouts that you just don't experience if you've never been a competitive athlete. And even mm-hmm. when you're a competitive athlete, it's, like, only in training that you push that hard to this place that I would always call it, you'd halo out mm-hmm. and you'd leave sweat angels mm-hmm. on the ground. You know, mm-hmm. this moment where... the world is sort of like at the edges disappearing and you're just so emptied out and your endorphins are so mm-hmm. crazy, your adrenaline's mm-hmm. so crazy and your lungs are burning and you're dumping sweat from all your pores, that there's this like clarity endorphin rush thing that I truly believe is the thing that hooks people. The people who get into it are like, keep going. And that's why they also like break their bodies for it. It's like, as you continue that practice for a long time, if you're like pushing your, you know, I don't know anybody, including myself, who used to coach CrossFit that didn't end up with like rotator cuff issues and this and that or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you chase it just for that thing. Yeah. So it's like, I mean, yoga doesn't do that to you.
No, actually, but, I think it does. I mean, I know there's a lot of de-emphasis these days on the asana portion because the asana portion has become a cartoon of itself. Mm-hmm. You know, like, jump around.
What do you mean? Like, oh, what like, asana like, meaning
you
postures?
Know, asana meaning postures. Yeah. Where yoga's got so many other components. But for me, the asana component was such a stilling an interior stilling of paying minute attention to the rotation of this bone, the placement of this muscle, the balance here, the core pull, the way the breath follows it. It became for me a real prayer. And I as I advanced in my practice and learned more complex postures and more difficult postures, I was also falling in love with the sense of possibility in co-creating a new reality in my body and life. And for women, you know, I was noticing, you know, I started teaching after that, and women would always get off on finding strength in their body, and the men would get off on finding new flexibility and new openness. And so this very intricate inquiry into, like, the what is the inner architecture of my being, I loved that. So it was a very stilling effect. And sometimes now I'll do the hot, sweaty jump around stuff, and a lot of times I'll do a still strong practice, but it's pretty powerful. I added in the mantra singing and breath work and all that stuff, but that came much later. Anyway, so I go to this yoga thing, and it was only in the presence of relaxation that I really understood its absence in the rest of my life, and I was completely hooked. So that was the first thing. So the process of unfolding that, as I relaxed and started melting places in my body, I started becoming aware of memories and other things and that were in my body, not the least of which, as you know, was the loss of my mom, that my mom had left and been gone from our home quite often when I was young, and then she was murdered. And so as I was coming more and more into this, like, there might be some things that are going on in me that are driving me that aren't healthy and aren't, you know, aren't for the good of things, that really, that practice really began this larger inquiry and healing, and what led me to do the trauma work.
So I don't, like, this isn't a murder podcast for me. It's, I don't need, like, juicy details to make an episode. But I think it's interesting just in what you went through. You said your mom was in and out before that.
Right.
And then my understanding of the story that you told me is that you didn't know that she had been murdered. You thought that she was just, she had left.
Correct.
And then it was a while before you found out the truth.
Not that long. I mean, I found out that she had been killed, that she was dead pretty fast. But it took me, they didn't tell us exactly the circumstances until later. And that actually really did shift my understanding of how the world was for quite a while.
Just so, that it felt more dangerous, more predatory, you mean? Or?
Yeah, yes. And also that you know, what was your relationship with the people who had lied to you? You know, that was also very interesting.
And that was your parents, basically.
Yeah,
your dad,
well, the whole family, right, would have had to, unless
they
didn't know, the whole network of the family. And I actually found out the truth only when I went back to visit my German family and they had newspaper clippings. That's how I found out. But in any case.
But I just think, okay, so but that does create, like, that's a huge, and you were a kid, you were like 12, 9?
I was
11.
That's
like a huge thing, though, to overcome later. And I think people nowadays people would say, like, oh, well, of course, that's a huge thing.
Yeah,
that's
but
have
then
effect.
They didn't, you know. My father, I don't think it was just that he particularly didn't have the coping mechanisms. I really believe that the society, like I was saying earlier, was a gloss over society. You know, you look good on the outside and you just man up or woman up, or as my friend Anna Judd says, kegel up, you know, that you just, like, find your inner will and you just move on through. That was the norm. And so he, like, gave away or burned or threw away all of her stuff, including pictures.
Oh,
there was no
gosh.
Funeral. And then they never told the people at school. Like, we switched schools and they never said, hey, by the way, these kids, their mom just died. So I mean, it was so bewildering, you know, and lonely. So bewildering and lonely.
Even though you had brother.
I had a younger brother who's 4 years younger, but he was 4 years younger.
Weren't
seven.
Super close. Yeah.
You know, what are you going to lean into your 6-year-old brother?
That's interesting to hear what you said about the predatory stuff, the feeling that the world is more dangerous, because I've always associated you with somebody who's, like, maybe in defiance of that. You just kind of wing it. You're almost reckless. You just go out and do things that you want to do since you were a kid.
I am like that now. But I
even when you were younger, though, when I was younger and from the stories of you as a young woman, that's something I associated.
You know, I've always longed for freedom, and I think in that way I'm actually very like my mother.
Yeah.
You know, she was a very much of a free spirit. She spoke a bunch of languages. Yeah. She played instruments, and she was feeling, the reason she was leaving was probably a lot because she felt so constrained by that that life. And so
yoga, when you got into this practice of yoga, you feel you started to discover areas of trauma and memory.
Yeah.
There, like that's just the on absence the of it was what made you aware that. And so how did that lead you then to like, yeah, continue telling me about that? Because I know you've gotten into this like serious violence rehabilitation and,
yeah,
and trauma work.
Well, so I was saying, well, you add meditation and all that stuff. But what happens when you begin to relax and start to sort of be an inquiry about what's going on in you is that you might like, and particularly if you start it with a physical practice, is you sort of scan your body and you'll notice that there are tight places. And when you let yourself sink into it, you find what is underneath it. And I'm still practicing that today. That's called inner coherence or inner alignment. And this work gradually does its thing on you. And so it led me to try other modalities like family constellations therapy,
right,
and things like that. So the inquiry began. And I was teaching a little yoga on the side, running my companies, doing all that stuff. And I ended up teaching in a fighting gym to a population of young men that I'd never, you know, I didn't really know how to teach them. They didn't want to take their socks off.
Santa Rosa,
Northern
right?
California, yeah. And the guy who was coaching them, you know, he's coaching these really intense boxers. And they're true athletes. They're, you know, lean animals. And they know how to move, but they're very constricted in a lot of their musculature, which wasn't just their sport. It was also sort of a lifetime of being protected and carrying armor, particularly around the thoracic and the shoulders. And he felt that they would benefit from having more mobility and more control of their breath. And so as I was going in there and working with his boxers, you know, the first it was they were incredibly teasing of each other for putting their butts up in the air or taking their socks off. And if I went in to adjust anybody, there was a lot of you know, kind of stuff. But as we became more comfortable with one another, they were such great athletes and observers that they really quickly integrated the work into their, and it affected their practice. So it gave me this little taste of what it would like, what it'd be like to bring the practice into places where it usually wasn't seen. And I saw a flyer for this training program to teach yoga in prisons with this guy, James Fox. And so I said, all right, well, that is a great next step. I'll go there. And this was the first, this was a major shift in my understanding of what happened to my mother. What is the feasibility and possibility of change in the human spirit? And what needed to be done in the justice system in the United States, and how this trauma question was rolling through transgenerational systems in such an immense way. Right. So, so that I think I've told you that story before.
But you even told everybody else.
So
this is valuable stuff to hear.
This is such a beautiful moment. So I'm going to take you into this class with me. We're in this pristine yoga studio, bamboo floors, white walls, light drifting in, and we're sitting in a circle. There's maybe 30 to 40 people, a couple, you know, probably 10 men. And one of the men is sitting at the front and he's in cross-legged position in Sukhasana and he's just beaming. He's got these beautiful clear eyes and he's extremely calm and he's the man who begins the circle and he says to the group, my name is Rusty. I spent 34 years in San Quentin. I murdered a woman in the summer of 77. And the first thing that I want to do is make an apology to any of you who have been the victim of a crime. And he went around the room and he made eye contact with every person. And of course he got to me. I lost my shit. I just lost it because I had never received that apology. They never caught the person who did that. And that was, even that was like the first movement toward forgiveness, you know, towards, towards like resolution. But I was more struck by the fact that he was out now, he was paroled. And he really had the air of a bodhisattva, of an enlightened being. And he was out teaching response, not reaction, and other kinds of tools and techniques to people in his community, to young men, to help them stop their violence before it begins. So he had become a peacemaker. And just so happened that the man who started the program off of which this yoga stuff had spawned was sitting next to me, Jacques, who you've met, this fantastic Buddhist who has really done all of us an amazing service through this program he started. He said, hey, So I had told them what had happened to me and my family. And he said, would you be willing to come into the prison with me into San Quentin as a stand-in for victims and their families and have a conversation with the inmates who are in our program, which is a larger program on emotional intelligence, somatic awareness, mindfulness, and victim-offender communication. So it's the last unit they do. And I stand in, I tell the story of the impact of the crime on me and my family, and then we have a dialogue. But you participate in a lot of the stuff before you get to that point. And I'll tell you, man, those men, when they started telling the story of their childhoods and the crime that they did and the systems that got them there, you know, we are not born in a vacuum with a karma that is all our own. We are definitely placed into systems that co-create our reality, that create our brain, that create our mind body. And the saddest part was, you know, many of them had entered when they were 17 or 18 or 19, tried as adults, and their crimes took minutes to commit, and they were usually at the intersection of some kind of drugs or alcohol, a bad place at the wrong place at the wrong time. Like, it was complete, you know, they were in more of a their stuff was more context driven than their own will,
right?
And then they spend the rest of their lives in prison.
Yeah.
So the presence of firearms, that was the other piece. So, you know, you sort of looked at, well, if those circumstances hadn't been there, where would those guys be today? And a lot of that answer comes after they're doing this work. There's significant shifts. So that was my first sort of insight into the systems on a personal level that create us, that we're all a part of.
So I don't know. So if you're somebody out there, and this is you, this is me, I mean, I definitely relate to the physical practices as a way of, like, sort of understanding this, like, physical connection, this somatic connection to trauma. And also a thing that I learned from that project that you were involved with, because I went to one of those things, I thought it was really profound when they said, they started people on their histories of violence. You always start with, like, telling your experience with, like, all the violence you've experienced, and that they were very specific about, like, violence doesn't just mean physical violence.
Mm-hmm.
What was it? It's like physical, psychic, emotional. There's economic, which is, like, taking from people.
Mm-hmm.
There's all these ways you can
do violence
others. or receive violence.
Mm-hmm.
And that these moments do create traumas, especially if you're young, you don't have context, you can't handle it, and things like that. I don't know, I guess I'm curious for you, because I think there's a lot of people at home, I don't know, even, like, diagnosing that you're like, oh, I think that was actually something big that I'm not looking at. And then how do you start working that out? You know, what do you do?
Oh, I have so much to say on this topic.
I think maybe it was Rusty who was the one who said, is he the one that said the breath and the word thing?
I don't remember. I don't know.
Because I think about that all the time. And the last episode I did, I read Fuck Breakups. It has a lot of some of this stuff in there. And among it, though, is that one phrase, but when they take everything from you, all you have is your breath and your word. And that when you strip yoga, you can strip yoga down to that, you strip anything down to that, intention down to that, mm-hmm. is everything's your breath and your word. Mm-hmm. And that it does seem to me that the beginning and end of these healing practices is there.
It's in full integrity in there.
Yeah.
In your breath and your word. Full integrity in your breath and in your word. That's absolutely true. I have so much to say on this. For somebody who's listening, you know, one of the most helpful things for me to learn was how violence is to your mind or spirit or body impact you at different stages of your development. So it's very hard to unwind traumas that were done before the age of 2.
Yeah.
The brain is having so much foundational programming laid that if you have abandonment or violence before that age, it's unlikely you're going to soften completely into that.
That's so hard to hear. That's like during all that border stuff, that was all I was thinking about.
Exactly. So if you're in that category, you set your expectations to, I've learned that you should set your expectations to creating more outward control so that you avoid situations that would trigger that. And you put more boundaries around who you're with, because you're not going to be able to regulate your interior response like someone who had no trauma or someone who had traumatic incidences later in life. But it becomes progressively easier to reverse those things in the brain the older you get.
Totally.
Over 14, it's very easy to do systemic restoration. And when you have really huge things that very immediate striking PTSD things like you do when you send young people to war. Those also have interventions that can be more unwound. But if you're one who received that childhood stuff, you just got to love yourself in a different kind of way. You learn, you take the pressure off of yourself, I guess is what I'm saying, that you're in so many places we're taught to self-regulate, like it's in us. We should really be able to control our response, just meditate more, whatever. But you know what? Sometimes you just can't. You'll never be able. So then you create structures and systems that basically create a coddling for you if it happened really young.
Just avoiding triggers.
Avoiding the situations that trigger that and the people that would trigger that. And, you know, not with any hatred or blame or hardness toward them. Just, this is what my nervous system can handle. This is what's good for me. And then you learn how to live that way. The other thing on emotional abuse, you know, when you talk, there the studies on kids who were, their parents were just fucking mean to them, you know, insulted them, made fun of them, blamed them, where the kids didn't feel safe, when that those linguistic abuses shut down the verbal processing centers in the brain. Kids who had that are worse at writing. They get worse on reading tests. They're like two grade levels behind kids that are just treated with general kindness. So know that your brain and your body are in response to the things that you've been given. You have a lot of power over unwinding those things, but it's not complete, and that you're really learning how to lean into others and ask and be present to receive that help is really vital.
Yeah, this is just heavy. It's just something that makes me so sad to think about. I think when you look at the world, when we look at like even like assholes in power who keep doing bad things, there's it just is really overwhelming to think about like these spider web networks of like reaction that like when trauma happens, it really does spread and keep going. If you even if you create more trauma in some kind of self-defense, that like that itself has its own like consequences and continues on.
Right.
And it can feel really overwhelming to think like, well, how's anyone gonna, you know, how are we going to like lock this stuff down?
Well,
like, how
are we going to fix this thing, society? The thing to lock it down is it takes time. And I don't mean like time elapsed time. I mean time in your everyday.
Yeah.
And that by keeping everybody really fully occupied and working all the time just to make ends meet, it's tough to find the spaciousness in your own day or in your own year or season to do the internal work. So I think there's a very strong correlation between the economics of life in America and the ability to create spaciousness and find the assistance to begin unwinding it. Because to learn, like these guys were in prison, they're doing this program for a year, every week for 5 hours. Okay.
Jeez.
So,
yeah.
You know, so if you want to learn how to like regulate your own, if you have lots of trauma, what if that was the case? I just heard this guy was at Summit LA this week, really amazing community.
Yeah, like literally, what if that's the case? When are you literally going to find the time?
Exactly.
5 hours a day or
so,
whatever.
So this guy, Mike Novogratz, is like one of the richest guys in the world. The interviewer asked him, you know, you failed a lot, but you're like the king of bounce back. What is that about? And he goes, you know what? Every time I fail, I take a lot of time off and I do work on myself and I figure out the answer to that question. And
he said, in jiu-jitsu, we say you win or you learn.
You learn, right. You know, and in most sports, they say you can't focus on what you failed on. You go to next play. But what I was really amazed at is here's the guy who seemingly has everything together. And instead of being like putting up a front.
Yeah, just
you
get
know?
Back on the grind. Just lock it down. Yeah, and just you like take the hit and keep moving.
He said inner work. He goes, people who do their inner work grow. And those who do all of their work and deal with all of their shit glow. And he goes, I'm committed at least once a year to spend a week completely alone, just doing work on myself and on an ongoing basis getting help. So I think if you're really in a place where you're, you know, I've done a lot of that. I've been really lucky to break away and try to change the inner programming and then in turn pass it on to the family. And
yeah, I think that's an important thing to emphasize about that idea. I think a lot of people who maybe have responses or feelings, and usually it comes from your own, like you have things that hurt in you and you resent that other people like are trying to fix them, or you're like, oh, come on, snowflake, kind of things like that, you know, like that it can also hit a brain, like a puritanical sort of American brain, that like self-care has becomes a joke. It's like, you know, the difficulty of accepting like putting on your mask on the airplane before putting on the kids, that like it's mm-hmm. not self, that you truly, I mean, from my personal experience with you, the time you spend like working on yourself and continuing to unwind whatever's going on in your generational systems and traumas and things, I truly feel, and my siblings have talked about this too, that like there's aspects of that that do the work for us, that like we don't have to figure that part out of the family system. Like something about you figuring it out alleviates.
Yeah, I take our a thing. Little. I take responsibility. I did it the other way. I'll tell you a funny story. Not a funny story, but a weird woo woo story about doing the. I was really struggling with like forgiving my mom for the whole all that stuff, and so someone gave me an ancestor prostration practice, which was super. It's 30 days every day for 30 days. You think of in front of you like arranged in like a clock, like a mandala, like a peacock fan. Pictures of all of the people in your mind who have ever taught you something beautiful, famous or not, spiritual leaders, people who loved you, anybody who looked on you with kindness and love, and you arrange them in sort of a mandala. And then you imagine on your right shoulder your maternal line, and on your left shoulder your father's line. And you begin, you raise your arms up and you collect all of that love and kindness into your body, and then you pass it through your shoulders, down your spine, and out your feet to your ancestors and all the lines behind them into wherever. So I'm about 21 days into doing this practice, which is like forgiving them and bringing them all the blessings. And I got calls from cousins that I hadn't ever talked to.
Crazy.
And I was like, is it possible that time space is not moving in a forward linear fashion, and that I actually am healing, and in real time it's resonating back to like cousins, second cousins the line somewhere else, and that they're calling to have dialogue out of the blue?
I know that that's very woo-woo, and I know that's how people will take that, but I don't think that's very woo-woo. I think like when you get into physics and quantum physics and stuff like that, time is known as a dimension. We only perceive it one direction, and that's like the deal. And most likely you can't time travel because someone would have already, or you splinter off into some other portal or something like that. But that being said, that the idea, like if you imagine like ripples in a pond, I think the part that becomes woo-woo isn't just like you do something here and that it would affect the timeline backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
That it would send ripples in the pond forwards and backwards and right here in the present. But I think also the thing that's maybe sounds woo-woo about is that there's some emotional, that there is a physical manifestation of consciousness or spirit or something like that, to which I feel, and this is all such like pseudoscience-y whatever, but I really do think like the same way people thought germs were a joke, like until Louis Pasteur or whoever, like, you know, was like, no, see, you can see them. And, you know, doctors being like, wash your hands, ha, 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 before surgery. Well, what's wrong with you, sir? You know, I just have a cigarette. It's fine. That kind of thing. Like, I do believe, like, we know 90% of existence is this dark matter stuff that we, or the mass of it, it's the stuff we can't detect. And I don't know. And I really think that there's maybe more going on in terms of like emotional weight and trauma and like ideas of love or kindness or humor or whatever that like we just, yes, we can't track it yet. But
well, there are some places that it's being tracked. Like, so we'll take it out of the woo-woo category. Let's just go to epigenetics. Let's just go to family transference. So basically, since you as a child are absorbing and mimicking a lot of what's going on in the family system, if there's secrecy or shame around a particular thing or a behavior that, say, your father developed in response to his, that they pass on unconsciously those behaviors to you, like being afraid in certain places, being resistant in other things. So their unexamined things do pass on to you, not only
in very practical
behaviorally,
ways.
Just behavior, very practical, observable behavioral mimicry in the sort of family values. And then in the medium term, there's an encoding that's wrapped around your gene. Our genes change very slowly. It's a long evolution. But the epigene, the little wrapper, is shorthand notes to your gene that tell the fetus what might be helpful in your lifetime to express genetically based on the possibility of your own gene fetus, based on what the father or mother has experienced up till that point in their life.
Wow.
And so you see a lot of studies, for example, that people who express starvation, their children and grandchildren in one generation had the expression of the same genes for starvation. So it's stuff like that. So there is emerging science
around it. Is that like the same? Is that why like a breed of dog is like It's a husky. It likes to pull stuff. That's what it knows how to do. You know what I mean? Like,
Well, I can't speak to the dog thing, even in the wild,
the way like an animal is born and like kind of has an instinct to hunt. Like it has to learn from its mother or whatever. But you know, whatever its thing is, it knows like automatically sort of what to seek out and do.
What it's built for.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, you see that in nature in a very practical way.
Oh, this is a total aside. Oh, but it's also a wonderful aside. Okay, so I saw this amazing book of Olympians once where they were all wearing black onesies, basically black bathing suits, and they had like a shot putter next to a gymnast, next to a you know, a hockey player, and the stunning array of human body types and when they're excellent, like peak in their sport, and how they were basically, their bodies were designed to do different kinds of real work, just like your breed of dogs thing. But that this idea that these designs were coming out of nature, this was probably one of the biggest movements in my life towards happiness, is to stop seeing myself as someone who liked nature or like went out into nature or wanted to preserve nature, but that I was nature.
Yeah.
That I was a completely growing being, like a flower or a tree or a bird or anything else that existed only by favor of the sun and only by favor of the air, and that I couldn't grow wrong, just like a tree or a flower couldn't grow wrong. And what an amazing release that was. I am nature. You know, completely whole and perfect and wonderful expression, not because my body type wasn't favored by this particular culture, that I rejected body type that wasn't worthy, or it, you know, people who have things, you know, parts of them that are like the unfavored gender or the unfavored skin color of this particular culture, you know, that that can never be a truth.
Right.
That you are nature and always perfectly growing and expressing as you was a very big aha.
Yeah.
And when I looked at those Olympians, it just enhanced that.
Yeah. There's a, I think it's Regina Spektor or something. I don't know. Or maybe it's Ingrid. I think it's Regina Spektor. She has a line in a song where she goes, I've got the perfect body because my eyelashes catch my sweat. Yes, they do. And I think about that all the time. Like my eyelashes catch my sweat. That like the, that we are these creatures that have been, you know, that have developed very specifically in response to a lot of things and are rather remarkable.
Yes, I mean that's the first. I have this little 9 gifts practice that I made up and it works for me. But the first gift is wonder and awe, and that eyelash thing is a perfect example. Like holy what?
Yeah.
Your eyelashes catch your sweat and the salt doesn't get, how amazing is that? And then if you start walking in the world and you really start paying attention, you're like, how does that work? You know, at the multitude of, micro miracles.
From Allie recently, I don't know if it was her podcast or her Netflix thing, Brainchild or something. Like this is one of those things that, the reason your fingers and toes get wrinkly is because, maybe gajillions of years ago, whatever, if you were in it like a waterlogged area, it gives you more traction.
Yeah, they make like little suction cups.
And it like lets you walk on rocks and things not be as slippery. Like that's mind blowing. It's like deflating your tires a little bit if you're gonna drive on a beach. This is
why science is so magnificent. So just imagine like you had to control the world, right? Yeah. There's so many people who are like about planning and there is no way, like the diversity of nature expressing itself is the same as the diversity of human activity. Like you look around the room at any moment and like all of the gazillions of hours of engineering and skill that had to go into just making this microphone setup work.
Right.
I mean, it's happening on the natural by ecosystems of people doing what needs to be born and creating what's right in front of them. And even so, the wonder experience is not just reserved for nature. It's also reserved for how does human creation, how does humanity construct itself? It's amazing.
Right.
And then, one more thing. See, this is...
No, keep going. It's fine.
There's this other piece on wonder, which I think leads to humility. Like wonder... So a while ago, I got caught up in thinking about scale. Like that... Somewhere I had read... When I was in school, they taught us Pangea, this idea that there were the continents all came together.
That we were all one big continent before it broke into all seven.
Right. So I read this science article that said that's actually happened 7 times on Earth in 400 million year cycles, or Rodinia, that there have been these pulsations
that we come apart and back together over and over
7 times so far on Earth, and that Pangaea was the last version of this. And I was like, how does a person who has a body that is lives 80 years or whatever even comprehend 1,000 years or 1,000,000 years, much less 400, whatever.
Yeah.
I'm probably getting the data wrong. But so that got me on this whole long exploration of that the very scale of our being limits completely our understanding of what's real. So that, you know, you only see with the naked eye things that are visible to your body size and your eyes capacity. And the whole history of scientific instrumentation has been the acknowledgement of the limitations of our human perception and the desire to go beyond that, the microscope, the nanoscope, the Hubble, you know, the things that amplify sound, things that project sound, things that read frequencies between bird song and whale song and find the languaging. And that, you know, as we get and as we amplify our perceptual capacities with instrumentation, you're having this like, holy, we knew nothing. We know nothing.
Yeah.
So whether you're talking about what's going on in your body or between you and another person or in the culture at large, like the whole movement is toward humility, you know? And in that humility, like, I don't know. It's possible that there's so much more at work. What is that thing? The more at work in heavens and earth, Horatio, than we will ever know, that Shakespeare.
Yeah, yeah.
And that if you live like that, you get a little bit of a softness in your day to day.
Yeah.
So there's
I agree with that. I think that's actually a really interesting way to think about it. That there is, like we say, small-minded. You know, we say, you know, if you have a experience that's so like limited, you have an understanding of men are like this, women are like this, cultures like this, I'm like this, I respond to scary situations like this. You know, like you've set your stuff.
Yep.
Which, you know, I feel like people who have, I don't know. I feel like people, and I'm not going to go into a political thing, but yeah, that's interesting. Do you want to move into the six questions part?
Well, I want to, I would like to do that. I also just want to close up an open thread on the trauma.
Yeah.
So we talked a little bit about your own individual experience of trauma and abuse, and we talked a little bit about what happens inside of the family system and how that get, you know, before you're born and the epigenetic piece, and then also the things that are happening in your immediate piece. But there's a whole nother basket that you're sitting in, and that is intergenerational collective trauma. And this is the piece that the work with Thomas and why I started going into his coursework. That, you know, like if you say, oh, my grandfather was a Nazi and he killed himself out of the war. And then, you know, you look at my grandmother was a Holocaust survivor and she came with all of that anxiety and started a new family in America. And then, you know, those people are carrying bigger stories for the whole culture. And when I started to understand sort of why conflicts persist across generations in regions of the world and why longstanding animosities never resolve, that's because you're carrying a cultural trauma.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
definitely.
And I see a lot of possibility in our country for waking up to a new period in our existence by acknowledging and doing some healing work around genocides and slavery and the gendercides that happened since in the last 300 or 400 years, and actually speaking to that, because whether we like it or not, it's still living in the real bodies today of our friends.
I think I
friends.
Just watched John Leguizamo has a show on Netflix. It was like a stage show. It's called... I think it's called like Latin History for Morons or something like that. And it is powerful. It's very good. But when you know, really start to digest that stuff, like because one of the points he makes is like Latin people are predominantly Native American, you know, when you, like a big chunk of their DNA. And when you really learn about the history of Latin America and America and the true history of America and just the insane, it was like, 78 million people just wiped off the face of the earth of the Native Americans that lived here. I don't know how we, I mean, because we are woo-woo, like our family, like we are raised to understand, I hesitate to say that word because it's real and I do feel like it's real. I do feel like it has practical effects, but I don't know how one could be expected as a culture to not like face those actions. Like this man you're talking about, this, yoga guy who killed someone, he starts the class and he goes, I murdered a woman in 1977 and I'm sorry. I don't know how you can get better without doing that. And as a nation, as people that like live
right.
in America.
He began my deeper healing on my mom stuff. It was and on my violent stuff by doing that. You have to come out. New Zealand did that. Mm-hmm. You know, they came out and they made a public statement and it was so powerful. They do healing rituals. Last week, I was in a week-long program where we're mixed genders in all the other weeks we do it. It's an 8-week thing over a couple of years. And this week, they pulled the men out on day two and put them in a separate group. And we were just with the same gender for 3 days, working day and night on a bunch of questions and inquiries. And then we came back together and there was a, you could perceive because of the direct absence and the return when the men walked back into the room, what it did in your body. Mm. And then everybody who's asked to tune in got to report what it did to their body. And a lot of the women were like, the minute the men came in the room, I felt so contracted. I felt this closed down. I felt all the openness that I developed in the circle with other women shut down. Or, you know, some people said they got turned on, like there was, but there was a very visceral response to having that energy come in the room. And it made the women aware of how much they were, and the men also, on the flip side of that, the men reported like they didn't want to come back in the room. They had developed this like where there was no anxiety about gender stuff and that they perceived women as like their angry mother or extractive and they just didn't want to deal. And the absence of that tension was so wonderful that they were reluctant to come back. And it was such a beautiful way to highlight the pervasive tension between the genders that's always there, also get people to speak to what was driving it, and then watch everyone's understanding that it's not a one-sided situation soften. That is reconciliation work. Mm. And it's worth doing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with you. I mean, we're on the same page. I think it's hard to look at the world and look at people and know that some people are never going to do it and they'll resent the idea of it. They'll joke about the idea of it.
Yeah.
They'll, you know, get mad about it. Yeah. And even the mildest version of like, well, look, why are you punishing? I'm not a racist. I didn't do that stuff. I didn't murder people. Not my race. Don't punish me for that.
Right. You know? Well, you know, I wasn't here when that was happening. My family was in Europe until the 60s. So, you know, I could say the same thing.
Your family's doing some other stuff in Europe.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you know, I'm saying like, you could also say that we're so intertwined. Just what does it cost you? What does it cost you to be empathetic? You know,
and I think just to take on, I don't understand why it's, I mean, I do understand. We want to run from things that are hard. We want to, that's true. And we, you know, I think are taught to like lawyer as early as we can to say like, no, it doesn't count because of this. Like not pay attention to your feelings about it or some kind of essential energetic truth that seems apparent when you pay attention. But loopholes about why
it's like me being willing to go in and stand in for other victims. I'm not their actual victim. Why would I take my time to do that? But you know, it's like playing my part in a larger karmic and in a larger unfolding. By the way, I don't think it's woo-woo. I mean, you know, I have a really straight up science educate, like technology, business, numbers, all that stuff. And the evolution to this point has been an expansion that includes all of that data-based stuff. I'm not coming at any of these discoveries with like a, you know, science for, what did he call it? What did John call it? Leguizamo? Science for morons.
Oh, history for morons.
You know, it's not like that. Yeah. I really look critically at this stuff and it seems to work. So
yeah, well, I also think it's important to think about like that things that seem quote unquote woo-woo would include things like once upon a time that people need to have weekends. They need to have a 5-day work week. It was things like people need to have days that aren't 12 hours every day.
Right.
Like these things that people go like, what are you talking about? We don't need to make laws around that. People don't need that much care. Okay. You know, and you'd be like, you know what I mean? It's the same reasoning. Why do you need that time off? Like, what are you going to do with that time? I need it to just think and heal and have a life.
Oh,
like these are things that are evidence of in the past for a long time felt like human society really was pretty predominantly on a march forward of like, you know what I mean? Like if you get into it, like what we're calling woo-woo is on the same scale as like owning other people. Like, you know, if you came before the idea that it's just obvious that owning other people is wrong in a world where like people kill animals all the time and they're like poor or they're not and you make war and you collect slaves when you win a war, that's like how Rome works and that's just how it is. You know what I mean? That like the idea that you would go like, no, all people are people. Like that would be a woo-woo concept. People can't be owned just because you have power over them.
Right.
That's not how it works.
Right.
You don't own someone because they were born in bondage to you.
Yeah.
Like, those are woo-woo concepts that, like,
at that time, would,
at that, time the, that, like, right. you make, that I don't think it's crazy to say that, like, this, you know, continuing, like results in real deaths, the, both the economic violence, but also, like, the police state violence and the for-profit like, prisons
yes,
and
yes.
the I mean, genocide
and it,
that
and
everybody answers for.
Black families have an average inheritance of $14,000 when someone dies, and white families have 90. It continues.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Anyway, so...
But I just mean, these are these people would think of these as these like ideas of reconciliation
right,
and stuff,
right.
but it's, I mean, it's
no,
the
it
be- only
it
way
begins,
that
it
you
begins
can...
begins a movement toward wholeness. And it also means for you that if you're harmed, you can also expect reconciliation on the personal. It's a, it's an all-around softening. It doesn't just go one way. You know, it, it creates a culture of meeting the other in their pain
yeah.
and being able to hold it.
Yeah. You know what? I would also say, not to get like super, like this is, I don't mean this sound conspiracy theory, whatever, but that there are limited and powerful parties who like really benefit from you buying into the idea that your pain doesn't matter and you should just get over
oh,
it.
Oh, for sure.
You know, like there's a lot of people who like stand to profit a lot from you just going like, suck it up, snowflake.
Right.
Like, you know, because...
That's. I don't think
you know what I mean?
It is a consumer orientation and a control orientation. Both speak to that. Like you'll have to buy stuff to feel better, and or you'll do what I you'll do behaviors
yes.
that make you feel better. So yeah, I agree. I agree with that.
I just think it's like whenever because there is like
but
a lot of stuff.
It's not a coordinated conspiracy.
It's that you don't need
that,
a coordinated conspiracy.
You know
conspiracy.
What I'm saying? It's like
yes.
it's, this is the thing about. When you notice a pattern that's happening, it's the individual actions of a lot of people who are building their lives off the same core principles, primarily
that's
unconsciously.
Right. That's right.
And so to dismantle it, you have to be conscious to go against it,
yes.
because otherwise you'll
well,
catch
this
it.
This is why ideologies like capitalism versus communism or whatever are real things.
Mm-hmm.
And some governments use them as weapons to destabilize other governments in the
mm-hmm.
past.
Mm-hmm.
But that it is true that when you've bought it hook, line, and sinker, like ideas like capitalism, like... You do make choices in business and in your life that are about like how do I make profit? Where does profit
right.
move?
That's
and,
true.
But you start commodifying everything, and you do it about yourself too.
Right.
It's no longer about like what does every person need, but what can everybody endure?
Well, okay,
including
I
myself.
I just want to speak to being in curiosity for a moment about the design of society and understand sort of the magnitude of shifts and experiments we've been doing. If you look back to like a primarily agricultural society, your day, you might not have worked cumulatively any less during your day, but it would have been in the context of friends, family, near your son if you were a father, near your daughter
right.
if you were a mother, touching the earth, making things with your hands. And,
well, they do say there's a thing that said peasants in medieval feudal Europe like had more time off than standard
well,
workers now.
This is kind of where I'm going with it. That then you say, well, we can parcelize all of these activities, and you know, this is the person who can take care of the garbage, and this is the one who can. So in the doing of that, it frees you up from all of the other tasks you need to do to run your household or your life, because
right.
everyone
one
can do it.
One person in town is going to make bread,
and
one
right.
person, and then we can.
And
yeah.
so it expands the available hours for work, and redefines the way work is, and
also,
it can really occupy everything.
Also,
so,
something we don't think about: lighting.
Yes, light.
That, like there's a really interesting
natural light or
podcast about that. That did an episode about it was 50 inventions that made the modern economy,
mm-hmm.
and one of them was about the light bulb.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about this thing that like you can measure like fuel and effort costs for per like kilowatt hour or hour of light or something like that.
Right.
That like it used to be, you just burn wood.
Right.
So we'd have to do all this wood gathering, and it burns pretty fast, and it takes a lot of cost to do it. And up and all through like tallow candles in the Revolutionary War era and stuff like that, up to now, you just turn on LED light bulb. And that, but you can like measure out like how society's allowed to advance because, well, now we've added more work
right.
hours, and it costs less for us to like spend time and effort on getting that light. But it's just weird to think about these practical like little things that fundamentally shift like your REM cycle, your rest cycle, which is like your
well,
cell's
your
regeneration
your
time.
Your embodiment and whether you're in harmony with your
yeah.
body. So you were talking about, you know, why would you have to legislate work and vacation, because once that time is freed up, you know, it will encroach on that. So in our human experiment in designing culture, we got a little off, so we had to make weekends. And now you have a whole nother wave of this global gig economy where you actually can never relax unless you saved a lot of money.
No,
because
everybody
you never
can email
know what's
you.
Coming next.
Yeah, you're always right. Someone can always get in touch with you, which PS is a principle of mine is that, like, no one has a right to have access to you at all times.
Correct.
And so this idea, because there are people out there, we all know them, who will text you and then a little bit later you don't text them back, will send some passive aggressive next thing like, well, okay.
Well,
or whatever.
Because I have early brain trauma, I have now, those people are no longer in my
but
life.
Yes, but I'm just, I think it's, I think it's really important for everybody out there who have this constant access to start to understand, like, that's not normal and nobody's entitled to that. You can, like, go to it when you
now
want.
Now you're getting on the sort of self-love boundary.
That's also why I turn notifications off. Like, just don't give yourself the stimulus.
Yes.
You know, go check it when you feel like
that's,
checking it.
That's putting an hour between going to bed and an hour after getting up without touching what Esther Perel calls, do you stroke your device first thing in the morning?
Totally.
And do you stroke your device when there's someone laying in bed next to you?
Wait. But also, I want to stay on that with the thing you just said about the gig economy thing. Uh-huh. There is this is, I think, also an insidious thing that, like, a lot of, that is, again, I think forces at work that we have to moderate within ourselves trying to get better. One of them is the equation of, like, basically the balance of freedom and risk,
right,
and suggesting, like,
ooh,
well, you're free. You're
really
free now.
Good.
You can
really,
work. You can,
really
you can
good.
Lift for, you can do Lyft driving. You can do all these gig economy things and it's totally free. Yeah. There's no unions for it anymore. But why would you even want those? You'd have to pay fees and do all this stuff. And now you can just do it in your free time whenever you want, but not realizing, like, and be like, yeah, it's free. It's awesome. It's like freedom and I can just make money. But, like, the implications on a wider scale of these things that are, like, there's no safeties, there's no protections. They do it because they benefit from it, like some limited amount of people, and that you get the freedom to do this stuff. Like, yeah, I can just make a buck whenever I can, as long as they pass the DMV test or whatever. But, like, there's also this risk involved, and that when we go out in the world, that, like, that's in America, and exceptionalism worn as, like, a badge of honor. And I guess I'm tying it back around to, like, I think about this all the time, that, like, when we do our work about our own traumas or problems or mental problems that we have difficulty getting over, like, or operating within, that I'm a big proponent of moderating how much am I victim blaming myself, and, like, being like, you fucking idiot, just get over it.
Right,
and now
right,
that's not useful.
Right.
But also it's not useful for me to fall into just going, like, all my circumstances, I couldn't do anything about the trauma to my brain when I was young and these horrible situations and blah, blah, blah. And I've come to have a question that I always ask is, like, well, what serves me? And it doesn't serve me to sit in, like, it serves me to have more, like, I can do it, I can get myself out of this hole, I know I can attitudes, even though I wouldn't force that on other people, because you're like, things happen that are out of your control and you have to honor that reality. But this balance of freedom and risk, like, I am free to say what I'm going to do with my life, and maybe that comes with some extra risk. And
well, I think on the freedom and risk thing, particularly in relation to the gig economy, it works for employers and it works for the contractors just as equally stressy to be starting a company like I am now and not know who I can count on next week, because they're probably going to go away to Bali and do a yoga retreat or something. I don't know. But it goes both directions. But I think what
that
an
definitely
important
goes both
piece
directions.
In the mental health question around this thing that's not outside, it's not it's your endocrine physiological stress response to a cultural situation that is actually quite stressful. Where's my next paycheck and rent coming from? So how do you take the question of your own endocrine and biological reality, which is creating dopamine or serotonin or not in response to your real life conditions, and decide what to pathologize and what to say, hey, the conditions should change so that I can not have these chemicals dropping into my body? And also, how do you know when the response to those situations that are external is unique to you and your own unique controllable situation, history, response, anatomy, biology, and how it's when it's a collective response to a really bad structural situation and lean into each other to change that situation? I think that's really vital.
I think there's some people on the, I don't know, and on the, like, more conservative side of the fence who can't, if you put yourself in a mindset of self-empowerment,
right,
I think it can be scary to admit that there are things outside of your control that just hurt. And you might go so far as like, it's not, this is a, someone was asking me recently, some pundit, it didn't matter if it was left or right or whatever. Everybody's just saying stuff now. Right. And you go like, someone was like, do you think they really believe that stuff that they're saying? And I thought about it and I truly responded that I think their definition of truth has shifted, mm-hmm. where truth is what benefits them.
Oh, interesting.
You know, like truth is the thing that is most useful and beneficial to my understanding of the world, uh-huh. my narrative, uh-huh. my career, whatever. Uh-huh. And that in getting into that, when you're dealing with your own trauma, I think a lot of people in this country that have that trauma when they're young and just turn into these like reactive, like whatever people, right. they go like, it's not helpful for me what you're saying about admitting things are wrong and wrong with me and hurt. What's helpful to me is just bite down and get through it. And it'll take them a long time, if ever, to really admit like, oh, maybe I don't have to live with this or whatever.
You can, yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
You can do that for a period of time, but eventually you get so hard that your quality of life suffers. You can't really receive love. You can't really give love. You can't relax into just real joy without downing, you know, a Jack Daniels beforehand. You know, it's like, it creates a numbing in your nervous system to have to grit and bear down on a problem or hold yourself so tightly. You know, we're like mycelium. We're all forming this interconnected network of beingness. I was at this talk not that long ago, and the woman who was speaking asked the audience to stand up if, and there's like 1,000 people in the room, stand up if you are responsible for another person's life or well-being.
Yeah.
Stay standing if you give a portion of your paycheck to another person. Stay standing if that person is not your wife or your spouse or child. She did say spouse, not wife. And stay standing. And so you have this huge number of people who are standing in the room who give a portion of their paycheck to someone who is not their wife or spouse, friend or family who needs it. And, you know, then she said, stay standing if you're first generation immigrant, which kind of turned it into a political statement. But prior to that statement, it was such an incredible visual thing to think about how many people are interconnected economically, energetically, and not because they have to. You know, you don't have to take care of your parent or your brother or whatever if they need it. But, you know, here we are doing it. And that this narrative of I'm alone, I have to grit my teeth, I have to bear it myself instead of banding together with others and saying, how can it be better? Softening around that is a lie. It's a lie. Anything that is a story of separation or not love is a lie. Is a learned behavior of protection that we can gradually unwind, I think.
That's good. I'm gonna move into the 6 cues from there.
Okay.
All right. Sorry, the first one is...
We could talk all day.
I know.
It's really wonderful.
It's
amazing. You're wonderful.
I wanted to ask you, so then let's do them. Let's do 6 quick cues. The first one is, do you have you been diagnosed with any mental disorder things or named conditions?
I had a depression diagnosis when John was going through cancer.
Yeah.
And I went to a psychotherapist then. And yeah. But it's not a permanent condition. I have no diagnosis at this point.
What about like PTSD or any of that kind of stuff?
That was never diagnosed, although I self-treated for that using an MDMA therapy protocol. Right. That was phenomenal.
Dovetail in the next question, is always about like medications that you've tried or been assigned or anything like that.
Well, I tried antidepressants in that window.
What kind? Do you know?
Zoloft.
Oh. Is that an SSRI?
If you ask me a question about it that's specific, I won't know the answer. All I know is that I felt so not creative.
Interesting.
I felt so numbed out and like blah, like happy, but like happy as if I was walking around with like an astronaut helmet filled with haze. And so I couldn't do that.
Got it.
And then I started doing it with nutrition. Like I really changed my diet. And so that, but I did,
how so?
I'm completely, you know, completely vegan and take supplements and things that like optimize what I can optimize in my chemistry.
The vegan helps you?
Totally helps me. It's like my body processes everything so easily, and I'm so clear. My skin's so clear. My eyes are so clear.
You eat gluten?
No gluten. No gluten anymore. Nope.
Huh.
I just, you know what? I love all that food. I love food. I love to cook. I mean, you remember the feasts we made when you were little, But I have to say, I've increasingly become like, my body's not a machine, but it's definitely a processing unit. And that even if I like that, this just feels better.
Yeah.
And so it's not about discipline. It's not about following a program. It's about literally cause and effect and experimentation on what feels better and coming to self-love.
Yep.
And saying, I love myself enough just to do what feels better.
Yeah.
That's it. No external rules.
Totally.
And that you have to just pay attention and make connections. Like alcohol makes me feel terrible, so I just stopped doing that.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I did have amazing experiences with creating a recovery from this, like the major traumas in my life by doing the MDMA intervention protocol.
Yeah.
And if people haven't done that, they can read about it online. Michael Pollan's got this new book, How to Change Your Mind, which is like normalizing psychedelics and psychotherapeutics again. And, you know, so there are a lot of the MAPS organization is having tremendous results with people who have severe PTSD from wartime situations.
For people that don't know, there was a recent study that came out. I was sending you and my brother, we were talking about it. I sent some friends. Basically, they did a study, and it was a small group, but pretty decent size for the nature of the study. It was 28 people who had diagnosed PTSD, and I think it was wartime PTSD, but I don't know. But it was definitely just PTSD, suffering all the insomnia and depression and dreams and stuff like that. And that they did these MDMA, literal Molly, ecstasy, the club drug, quote unquote. They did these sessions, three sessions over 3 months, and they said that 76%, I believe, a year later had no diagnosable PTSD anymore. And that after, I think, one session, they said 43% of people said that they didn't have those reactions anymore.
So the way
it didn't solve everything for everyone, but they could no longer be diagnosed as like, you have PTSD, which is, I mean, that's insane.
It's powerful. What the brain does in PTSD, this is from my general understanding, is there's something that's so traumatic that happens that you put a compartment around it. You basically put a membrane around it and push it off in a corner. And that when it gets triggered, you can't actually be in the moment with the rest of your life.
Mm.
So it's like a bifurcation of the carving out in the brain. And the way MDMA works in the brain is to eliminate, it drops all of your positive feeling chemicals from the next 2 or 3 days. Your own chemicals are drained from your future supply and dropped into your brain at once. So you are feeling so clear and high and light and good, and you're completely lucid, but you're feeling so good that your sense of fear goes away. You're just not afraid of anything. And in that moment, the therapist will ask you, so about that thing that happened to you that you wanted to talk about, why don't we take a look at that now? And with no fear at work, you can bring it into memory and look at it from all directions and examine it and realize that you are here now in this room and safe, and you're present and looking at that. And it basically pops the membrane and allows you to reintegrate perceptually that thing that happened into your current reality, that you're no longer threatened by that thing. That's how it works. So it's a pretty powerful therapy.
Yeah.
There's other plant-based things like psilocybin studies that are being done now that if you have a chance, Louis Schwartzberg and Paul Stamets just are doing this movie Fantastic Fungi, which is more broadly on the life of mycelium networks and mushrooms.
That stuff's amazing when you start learning about that. It's amazing. Insane.
And they were highlighting a study that was done at Johns Hopkins on people who were at end-of-life care with cancer and having tremendous anxiety about their impending death, and then doing these controlled studies with what psilocybin did. And the impact was so profound that the FDA now has that as a fast-track on the fast track process to an emergency intervention.
Psilocybin?
Yeah.
Oh.
So as a
for what?
For people who have end of life grieving.
Wow. Yeah, I've honestly I've done a very small amount of any kind of psychedelic stuff, just a little bit of mushrooms before, and I'm very intrigued over the last few years now because I didn't have any like big crazy experiences doing it I want the one time that I did some at Burning Man, actually I spent alone and I was out in the playa. I mean, it's such a joke how much Burning Man is like the thing that whatever. But I felt like I described it as I could only see truth and that it was very introspective and positive overall. And I do associate that trip, no pun intended, but that with like a turning point and like some decisions and realizations about my life that I guess I never put together till now, because they do say about these things that they can be like intervention level things. But that whole event led me to finally seek out psychiatric help.
It might be a key instrument in creating that spaciousness we talked about earlier.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
So
there are a lot of people who say that they can get at that by just being in stillness. I would say another big movement for me was going and sitting in silence, like 10 straight days of silence. No talking, yeah. No reading, no writing, no
more
eye contact.
More stuff that like, must be nice. Like, must be nice. Time. Well, you know, I mean, that's not necessarily
that
because
was
that sounds
post-child
so
rearing, but, post-child rearing. Right, but it was really about day three. The author, Mary Roach, calls it being stuck in a phone booth with a madman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you're
yeah,
just
yeah.
Like, oh my God, it's my...
It's amazing, Mary.
You know, and so by day five, though, I felt this incredible upsurge in energy, like from stopping the leaks of my talking and my listening and not taking things in, and all of a sudden got really still. And by day seven, I was like, wow, what yeah. a world. And you actually could see that none of the things you were reacting to were actually happening. They were all your brain making up shit that was not happening right now, and you were always in control yeah. of the response that you were having. How much of your day-to-day suffering is because you believe your thoughts? And it was so great. So I wow. would say, you know, those are run all over the world where you can, if you can make the time, you can go and do them for free. The Genka Foundation offers, they're done 10,000 times a year over the world wow. for free, where you go and you're in a guided sit. And you basically sit five times a day. You walk in silent meditation the rest of the time. And you're just silent. And you do nothing. And you'd be surprised at how difficult and how freeing it is simultaneously to just be by yourself and do nothing.
Yeah, that sounds really
Vipassana,
cool.
Vipassana, that's called.
Vipassana.
Yeah, so.
What's something cheesy you find inspiring? That's the next
I'm
question.
I'm a super nerd, so I like everything cheesy.
I know.
I mean, I still like Pocahontas songs, you know what I mean? And Disney songs those things, like something cheesy. You know what was cheesy today? I went to the polls in Los Angeles and I walked into this fucking school gymnasium and there were turkey handprint posters and there were like, we're all going to college with like big banners. This is like an elementary school, right? Go to college, kids, like with banners from all these colleges attached to the wall and like the earnestness of the belief in the American dream, and that there were 12 languages on the poster for the voting instructions, and that people were lined up out the door. And, you know, it was so sweet and hopeful that I had to sing America the Beautiful.
Yeah, really. Yeah, that's very good. That's very good. Very cheesy, very inspiring. What's something dark about you? I guess we talked a lot throughout this podcast, but
I have a dark side that really, I cannot understand how I can let my money support war and violence and be part of the state machine. And sometimes I get really dark around that stuff and a little bit of a desire to be like a pirate, you know, and try to figure out a way to help as much good happen and keep as much out of the system where bad is being generated. Yeah. And that means to me violence and separation as much as possible. So,
that's
tough. Yeah, those are places.
Yeah, I think with that a lot, that's back to some of our like shared generational or shared national trauma kind of things. And also, you're involved in the trauma that you create and the trauma that creates back and whatever.
Right.
But I think with that a lot, that was like, I had a thing about that when I was a kid, and I would think like how crazy it was that people were like, they're fighting for our freedom, about these people invading Iraq. And you'd be like, that doesn't make any sense. There's no freedom being threatened there, until I like thought about it more and it, like time passed. And I looked at the world and grew up a little bit and I understood imperialism and colonialism more. And you're like, oh no, they're fighting for our freedom. If the freedom is to have like AC running all the time, the way we like it, and our oil cheap and our clothes cheap, that like Bangladeshi factories collapse so that we can have you know, $20 shirts or $10 shirts at H&M or whatever, all these things that are like, no, they do that. They do that stuff so that they can steal and enslave and we can live this way. Like, that's why they do it. And I think that that's a dark thought.
I think I've always had that experience, but like,
I mean, that's why I get so mad about, like, I get parking tickets and I would joke about, like, well, this amount of money is going into the system and that is this percentage of a Tomahawk cruise missile, which isn't true. Like, there's different taxes that do that. But you know what I mean? Like, that feeling that you're paying into it is really hard.
It's a very big feeling. I was listening to a piece on like a radio show that was talking about drone warfare in Iraq,
yeah,
and how they were trying to do this very precise cyber war, where not cyber war, targeted war, and they had sent basically their reconnaissance to decide whether to target a compound. This particular compound was to fly a little drone around this compound in the middle of the day when it's 116 degrees, and that in that particular culture, nobody's outside in the middle of the day, and that they only saw one man and they didn't see any women and children, and so they were confirmed in their understanding that this was an ISIS headquarters. But what was happening is that the wives and the children, everyone was inside sleeping, and they all came at night. And when they were out in their garden in the evening, the home was bombed. The children were killed. It was just a man who ran some vineyards and fruit orchards in that particular part of the country. And he went through a process of restoration with the U.S. Army, or the U.S. the forces over there. And they offered him something like $200 for $1.6 million in damage to house, equipment, farm, the loss of his wife, the loss of his daughter, the loss of his nephew. Like it was, and they had taped the interaction between the army representative, the military representative, and him. It was so heartbreaking, you know, and I'm sitting there going, this is me. This is my money, my labor and life energy that's going to feed that system. So when I get dark, it's around that I'm complicit and I feel powerless to shift it.
Yeah.
So I can even feel myself getting dark, you know, in the process of talking about it.
Yeah.
I just don't want that.
Yeah.
Violence is the ultimate form of disconnection from yourself, from nature, from other beings. And it is wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and I know you do a lot of stuff with fighting and learning how to control and create offense and defense and listen deeply, and that it can be a very intimate thing for people who are fighters. But this sort of
consensual and non-consensual violence are very different things.
And that you're, I just feel like that is a complete failure of all the other higher order skills of being human, diplomacy, you know, everything.
Yeah.
So, that's my dark. Yeah, dark that's a good side. One.
What's the last gorgeous thing you saw?
Your face.
That's nice.
Oh man, I feel that every day. I was in downtown LA the other day at the top of a skyscraper, and at night, and the whole LA cityscape was laid out sparkling and interesting, but it was under an incoming rainstorm. So you had this sensation of the wind and the coolness running over your skin. And then the divider line between the two cloud layers was right at the height of the skyscrapers. And the light was all being captured right underneath it. And it looked like the whole city was a glowing orb under this cloud cover. So there was that.
That's
and
good.
I saw Mason doing some kind of booty dance. And that was also
he's the
gorgeous.
Funniest. He's our 5-year-old, the youngest member of the family unit.
My grandson.
And then last, I have my don't kill yourself list. You know, coffee, sandwiches, lavender soap. What's something accessible, relatively common, that's just like, hey, stay alive for that?
Steam rooms.
Oh, steam rooms are good.
Eucalyptus steam rooms or saunas, that kind of thing. Hot springs. Go out in the woods and find a hot spring. Plunge yourself in hot water.
Just hot water.
Hot water. Really good. Late night massage with your bestie.
Yeah.
You know, the person who, anybody who loves you or you love giving or receiving that touch.
That's good.
Oh, I have so many, you know?
I know. But,
the possibility of something different happening tomorrow, probably.
Yeah, that's good. I love that. All right, thanks. Thanks for doing this. I'm glad I was fun. It was fun to talk again. It was fun. I'm psyched about this too, as a thing of like, maybe for some people, I think we have a cool way that we talk for a mom and a son
Oh God, you know? It's like we start and there are so many different directions.
Yeah.
You know,
I don't know that a lot of people I know, I don't know that they know they can talk to their parents like this. And maybe parents don't know they can talk to their kids like this. That you can just, that you're people and you can just talk, you know, have ideas.
Your grandmother used to say, you talk to that baby like he's an adult.
Yeah, I know. I tell people that all the time. Because like you're saying that pre-2 stuff, I think you're shaping things. You're putting things in there right then. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I know you have had a mixed bag on your upbringing, but I do think one of the things that was really lovely is that before your dad sort of had some mental health trouble, you know, he carried you around and he sang to you in Japanese
and he
coddled you and like really loved you with his fullness. And that being loved and feeling that is such, if you can mimic that feeling later in life that you're loved and accepted, you have won the mental health battle. That is my current feeling.
Well, I also think things you did about like taking us to museums and stuff and when we were young. And I feel like from a very young age, I did feel very instilled with a kind of like wonder and understanding that the world was full of beautiful things and like a curiosity and desire to see as much of it and learn as much about it as I could, you know?
Like I don't know where I got that idea, but my idea was I wasn't really happy in my work. Like I'd wanted to be a dancer or an artist or something like that. And I had this feeling with you guys that I would want you to do in your life what you loved. And that the only way to know what you loved would be to take you to do a lot of different things. And that if I then watched you closely, that the things where you lost yourself and lost yourself in flow, I just take you back to those because they seem to be really a fit. Not try to make you do the things that society wanted you to do. But like, and in general, what ended up happening is that everybody found a gift line. Like, okay, you know what whales communicate across long... I'm sorry, one more thing.
Yeah.
Whales communicate across long distances by basically through compression lines in the water. And they operate like underwater fiber optic cables. And so a sound can travel a very long distance in the water. And I feel like when you hit that... sort of wave layer that in your life, like when you hit the frequency where things can focus and you're in flow, you just, you move, it moves so easily.
Yeah.
Everything's so, so beautiful. And that you hit it with writing and acting and your brother hit it ironically with music and, you know, which he isn't doing. And Sam hit it with design and visual arts and she's thriving in that field. So, you know, that was driven as a response or a reaction to my own experience of not having those gifts seen. And I would just say anybody who, if you don't know what you're here to do in your life, then just take yourself to a lot of stuff and notice where you relax and where your spirit lights up and just keep going there until it becomes clear.
Yeah. Do you know the Disclosure song where it goes, when a fire starts to burn, right, it starts to spread? Yeah. Anyway.
I don't, but it's a good song. I'm going to go listen to Regina Spektor and I'm going to go listen to
that. And lastly, people should check out Rosebud, as long as I have you.
Oh, self-care. Yes. I have a new line of skincare for the intimate area. It's greater vulvar region skincare, all plant-based. It just got called by a major beauty publication, La Mer for down there, which I really like. And I started this, I got the idea a long time ago and I've been formulating it for a while. And then last year I got really serious about it and I got the chemist from Paracone and Jessica Alba, which are great lines. And a lot of grace in the designer showing up. And, you know, I'm making basically true skincare, not in the sexual or reproductive theater kind of stuff, but actually true skincare for soothing and caring for that skin, rebuilding tissue laxity, bringing lubrication, arousal for those times when it's needed, and other things. And it's a line, but it's got a bigger mission of being a tool for more self-love, complete transparency and acceptance of all the bits of your body, and a way of spreading reverence in the world for what is feminine, in the hopes that if it's inside of a person, this reverence for the self, it'll roll out into the expectations they have of the community and the expectations they have of how the world builds systems to support this feminine. And
where can they find it?
Rosewoman.com.
Cool.
So,
all right.
That's my thing.
Thanks, Mom. Christine Mason.
Thanks, Jared.
I love
Thanks,
you.
Thanks, Jerbear.
Thanks for doing Michael Bear with me. It was fun to talk to a person again. I'll do more interviews again.
It was fun to talk to you. I love you.
All right. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.